Good morning. The Bible reading this morning is the entire 45th Psalm, Psalm 45. My heart overflows with a pleasing theme. I address my verses to the king. My tongue is like the pen of a ready scribe. You are the most handsome of the sons of men. Grace is poured upon your lips. Therefore, God has blessed you forever. Gird your sword on your thigh, O mighty one, in your splendor and majesty. In your majesty, ride out victoriously for the cause of truth and meekness and righteousness. Let your right hand teach you awesome deeds. Your arrows are sharp in the heart of the king's enemies. The peoples fall under you. Your throne, O God, is forever and ever. The scepter of your kingdom is a scepter of uprightness. You have loved righteousness and hated wickedness. Therefore, God, your God, has anointed you with the oil of gladness beyond your companions. Your robes are all fragrant with myrrh and aloes and cassia. From ivory palaces, stringed instruments make you glad. Daughters of kings are among your ladies of honor. At your right hand stands the queen in gold of Ophir. Hear, O daughter, and consider, and incline your ear. Forget your people and your father's house, and the king will desire your beauty. Since he is your Lord, bow to him. The people of Tyre will seek your favor with gifts, the richest of the people. All glorious is the princess in her chamber with robes interwoven with gold. In many colored robes she is led to the king, with her virgin companions following behind her. With joy and gladness they are led along as they enter the palace of the king. In place of your fathers shall be your sons. You will make them princes in all the earth. I will cause your name to be remembered in all generations. Therefore, nations will praise you forever and ever.
Thank Jonathan for that lengthy reading. This psalm we're studying in these early sessions, when I have the assignment to speak, some of the psalms that are written by a group of writers called the Sons of Korah. This psalm is unique of their psalms because this is a psalm that is also considered one of the royal psalms, which is a category of psalms classified by its subject matter. Royal psalms are psalms which are written about Israel's kings. There is a little bit among scholars, anyway, disagreement about this psalm. Some classify it not only as a royal psalm, but as a messianic psalm. James Smith, in his commentary on the Psalms, points out that it has long been considered a messianic psalm by both Jewish scholars and by the early church writers, those that wrote prior to the 6th century, what are called the Anti-Nicene Fathers. When they comment on the psalm, they say it's talking about the coming of the Messiah. On the other hand, Tommy Peeler, who's a gospel preacher and college professor, in an article in a book he wrote, rejects the idea that it's a messianic psalm, but it's just a psalm about the king and celebrating a marriage of some unidentified one of the kings of the people of Israel. And the decision as to how to treat this psalm, whether we look at it as a messianic psalm or not, has to do with how we look at that one little passage. And so there are issues either way. For instance, if this is a psalm describing the marriage of one of the kings of Israel, then the abiding question is, which one? David didn't write this psalm. If he wrote it, you could very easily say, well, he's writing about his marriage. But this is written by someone other than a king, so what king are they concerned about? Then the second thing, if it's about a human king, as you look at some of these verses, if you listen to some of the descriptions, the description of this king is very idealized. And so which man could fit all of those descriptions? Who is worthy of such praise as is the king in this psalm? And so, on the other hand, if you interpret the psalm as a messianic psalm, the question really becomes, how do you look at some of the historical references in there? For instance, there's a reference to Tyre, and by the time the Messiah comes, the kingdom of Tyre no longer exists. And so you have those kind of issues. And so I'm going to tell you, I don't think it makes a lot of difference in terms of getting a feel for the things that the psalm is saying. I lean towards the position that it is messianic, but with a lot of those prophecies, there is a historical figure that foreshadows the coming of the messianic king. So I keep that in mind. So the psalm begins with that introductory statement that my heart overflows with a good theme. I address my verses to the king. My tongue is the pen of a ready writer. And so, regardless of which approach someone takes, this is an expression of praise and goodness towards the king. Now, in the Hebrew manuscripts, the superscription, which is often put in your English Bibles, which is not a part of the psalm itself, it just identifies more about the psalm, identifies it as a maskil, which means it's a teaching psalm, and gives it the title of Song of Love. So it is a very, the idea is celebration of love and as expressed in the king. And so as we look at this, then we're going to break this down into parts, and I'm not putting, because it's a long text and Jonathan read it all for us, I'm not going to reread them, but as we look at this, I put on the top of the slide there for you to see the part of the psalm we're talking about. You can keep your Bibles open and look at that. And so the first thing that's described is the bridegroom, who is the king. And there is praise given for the king. And this is, when I mentioned it was idealized, it's very idealized because what is said about the king? He's fairer than the sons of man. He has grace poured out upon his lips. All these are in verses 2 through 5. He's blessed by God forever. Splendor and majesty is his. And that would be true of any royal wedding, the splendor that's connected with that. He is victorious. He is the cause of truth, meekness, and righteousness. Or the causes of truth, meekness, and righteousness are his, which contrasts to many kings, because many kings, their causes are wealth and the growth of their kingdom and military strength and things like that. And the people submit to your teaching. And so here are these seven things that are said about this king. And, you know, you have to look at this in light of the reality of things. Generally speaking, if somebody is writing a poem to celebrate a king's marriage that's going to be read at the king's marriage, human beings would have a tendency to accentuate everything positive they could about the king. So I don't think it's a valid argument to say that, well, if this was about a specific king of Israel, there would be more negative about him in here. Not at his wedding, not at this big celebration. So that necessarily does not really help determine whether this is a messianic psalm or not. But as it celebrates it, says that in verses 6 through 8 that the throne is God's throne. And this is the point of disagreement about whether this is a messianic psalm. If you take the non-messianic position, you take the normal political, historical political position about the rule of kings, and simply saying the throne is God's throne because kings rule by the appointment of God. And this developed into the medieval times to the whole idea of the divine right of kings, where kings were not answerable to anything else other than their own will, because their will was the will of God. And so the idea would be that this praise is expressed because the king is God's anointed, so of course he's on God's throne. On the other hand, and I would be classified in this group, I have to think of this as messianic ultimately. And the reason that I do is Hebrews chapter 1, verses 8 and 9. Now, we're going to study Hebrews a lot in the next two quarters on our Wednesday night class. But Hebrews starts out in the first chapter with praise and exaltation of Jesus as the Lord. And so it's very interesting that in that first chapter of Hebrews, beginning in verse 8, the writer of Hebrews says, "But of the Son, he says, 'Your throne, O God, is forever and ever, and the righteous scepter of the scepter is the scepter of his kingdom. You have loved righteousness and hated lawlessness. Therefore, God, your God, has anointed you with the oil of gladness above your companions.'" So the Hebrew writer quotes directly from Psalm 45, verse 7, and says, this is talking about Jesus. Now, to me, that settles the question. That ultimately, this psalm is a messianic psalm. That while there may be certain factors that are could be attributed to a certain king, if we knew which king was being talked about, that might be so, just as his promise to David that he would have a son immediately referred to Solomon, but in the long run, it referred to Jesus, the Messiah, coming as a son of David. And so I think the praise for the king that both precedes and follows verses 6 and 7 in the psalm are definitely an identifier that this is a messianic king. And that brings rejoicing to all those who are devoted to Israel, including their current king, representing that they are God's kingdom and that this is the promise that as God has made for them, that ultimately he will give them an exalted king. So then the second part of the stanza of the psalm talks about the bride in verses 9 and through the second part of verse 9 all the way through verse 12. And so how you approach this stanza depends upon which position you take about whether it's a messianic psalm or not. And so it just flows from which position you take. However, regardless of which position you take, this is the difficult stanza in the passage. This is the one that presents the problems to either viewpoint that you take. And so let's talk about that for just a second. In the non-messianic view, you have the problem of which king's wedding is it? If it is a specific king, which one? And if it's this significant and it's this great a celebration, why is he not identified? And the second is the daughter of Tyre is pictured by the people that take the non-messianic view as that this is the bride. So they were celebrating the king marrying a daughter of Tyre. And so good Bible students will recognize the problem that, as far as I know, there's only one king of the children of Israel. Well, there's one of the United Kingdom, Solomon, who took a bride from nearly every nation. And then, of course, Ahab, his wife Jezebel, was from Tyre. Solomon's taking of a bride from Tyre was part of the problem. He took them from Egypt. He took them from elsewhere. They are what led him away from God. So you would hardly say that that was a celebratory thing. You could not see this being praised for Ahab, because Ahab was the enemy of God and God's prophets all along. Among those who take the non-messianic view, there is the group that tries to identify the king by the fact that they are married. This bride is one of the a daughter of Tyre. The group that says, no, you can't tell which king it is. This is just a generalized description of how the people would react in the case of any royal wedding. Now, there is a point that I do want to point out before we go on. And that is, if you look carefully, the passage does not say that the bride is the daughter of the king of Tyre. It says that they sent presents. So I think those who try to narrow in and say this is this king because of this political marriage and so forth totally missed the point. Now, on the other hand, the messianic view which I take, there is still this question about the mentioning of the daughter of Tyre. Because from the messianic view, you understand how the bride is identified. If you believe this is talking about the marriage of the king, the Messiah, the New Testament says his bride is the church. And so Brother Smith, in his commentary, suggests that this reference to the daughter of Tyre is simply an indication that Gentiles will be accepted into the church. And of course, the problem with that is the same one with the other position. It doesn't say she's the bride. It just says that they send gifts. And so, regardless of which position you take, this reference to Tyre is problematic. To me, the most logical explanation of it is that whenever this was written by whichever son of Korah wrote it, Tyre was still a major influence on the people of Israel. If you remember, all of the materials that were used to build the temple came from where? Hiram, king of Tyre, helped build the temple. And he was a supporter of David and Solomon. And historically, the kings of Judah particularly had good relationships with Tyre. So I think it may be nothing more than a reference from the writer of the psalm, because that was the foreigners that were thought kindly of the children of Israel, be that as it may. Well, we're about out of time, and so we get to the last stanza, which is about the marriage itself. And this stanza really emphasizes the grand nature of the king's wedding. And, of course, that would be a fitting description of any royal wedding, but it's particularly fitting when you take the messianic viewpoint here, because we come to the New Testament, and we are immediately drawn to two scriptures in the New Testament, Ephesians 5, verse 27, that he might present to himself the church in all her glory, having no spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and blameless. And so spiritually, the Apostle Paul looks at Christ as the bridegroom and the church as his bride and says she will be glorious. And that is certainly what is described in the last stanza of this psalm. The other passage is the famous wedding scene in the book of Revelation, chapter 19, beginning in verse 7. Let us rejoice and be glad and give glory to him, for the marriage of the Lamb has come and his bride has made herself ready. It was given to her to clothe herself in fine linen, bright and clean, for the fine linen is the righteous acts of the saints. And then he said to me, write, blessed are those who are invited to the marriage supper of the Lamb. And he said to me, these are the true words of God. Then I fell at his feet to worship him, but he said to me, don't do that. I'm just a fellow servant of yours and your brethren who hold the testimony of Jesus. Worship God, for the testimony of Jesus is the spirit of prophecy. And so the Revelation looks at that marriage feast as part of the victory of the saints, and that is glorious. And so I said earlier at the beginning of this that I think it's logical to assume that this is both a royal psalm and a messianic psalm. But I think the difficulties that I mentioned are attributed to the fact that psalms, whenever we read psalms, we have to realize that they are poetry. And sometimes poetic language is not literal or historic. It's for the impact of it. And so it's what is easy to recognize and see that it does definitely apply to Christ and his church is that this psalm is an expression of the glorious nature of what God has in store for his people. It will be a glorious time. And so we'll end there, and Brother Bragg has the prayer, and then we'll be ready to go to our Bible class at the appropriate time.